So maybe you could just start by introducing yourself.
From the beginning?
Yeah, well, as far back as you want to go. That would be great.
Okay, I'm Chandra Natarajan. So I'm a senior data scientist at a startup in Silicon Valley at the moment. Prior to that, I was a postdoc in applied physics for 5 years. Prior to that, I did a PhD in applied physics in Scotland.
And I think before you did your PhD in Scotland, you had a bachelor's degree in...
electronics.
In electronics, and also in technology, is that right?
So I had a... In India, mostly the courses are based on like either science-based or engineering or technology-based. So the course that I did was called Electronics Engineering. That was the major, but I had a bachelor's in technology. That was the name of the degree that I had. I would say it's mostly like technology or electronic engineering-based course.
And when did you first become interested in science? Like, do you remember? Was there something specific that happened? Was it in school that you started thinking about science and technology?
So my parents, or my dad, was an engineer. So like he had been working with the telephones in India. In our house, we had the first kind of like landline in my class and things like that. So it was very interesting from until. So I took like electronics through that path because like my dad was an electrical engineer at the time. So there was no electronics at the time, I think.
So would he bring stuff home from work that you could
So like all my science projects was mostly like electronics projects because like his friends would come and help me to like build things.
Yeah.
So all along it was mostly like building some electronic circuits as my science project for different classes. Mm-hmm. So that is how I worked. And also like they put me in like computer science classes. So when computer first came in school, it was around, I was in my like 11th grade, no, like 7th or 8th grade. So that was the first time we had like computers and things like that. So at that time my mother put me in like some private schools where they would teach me like programming and like play, mostly I played games. But but I learned like the basic programming skills there. And then when I did my undergrad, the thing that I really liked about programming at the time was we used to have the 8085 processor. So I used to code on the processor itself directly by using the like mnemonic codes. So that was very interesting for me at the time. So that is how I learned my programming skills. So also like I kept along with electronics mainly because I had a lot of my friends going into software engineering. So whatever field we studied, we all like landed in like software engineering jobs in India. So my friends would say like electronics is something that is very difficult to learn. So you should learn it in school. Software engineering is that you can pick it on the side. And like my course, the Bachelor's of Technology course, where my major was, so in American terms you would say like in the major was like electronics, but the minor was like software engineering. So that is how it was.
Okay. And so then when you did your PhD was in physics.
Yes.
And so did you find that was kind of a change for you from what you've been doing before?
Yes. So I came to the UK to do my master's in nanoelectronics because I wanted to like go to the like next level in electronics. So I thought I would do like nanoelectronics or VLSI design at the time. And then when I was in like nanoelectronics course, I got into fabrication, or, like fabricating devices in the lab. So my supervisor at the time was John Cunningham from University of Leeds. So he taught me how to use like build these like small tiny chips and how to test them, and I got into almost physics at that time. So like studying the like flow of electrons, and so at the time it was like borderline like physics and electronics. So then he said like I was ready to like switch to physics if I want to, and things like that.
And so you decided that you wanted to try the physics part of...
Yeah, I was looking for a job, I was like, still I had the electronic fabrication thing going.
Yeah.
So I was thinking like, oh, I'll get into like some fabrication kind of role, or like some sort of device handling projects. So that's why I was applying for all these projects which involved like fabrication or like testing and like characterizing these chips. So that is what, those were the projects that I was applying for.
Yeah.
And then I got Robert's projects. And then I think Robert also knew John from the past. Yeah, they both were my like supervisors and masters, like Edmund Linfield and John Cunning.
I guess you worked as a research fellow at Stanford for over 2 years.
Yes.
And how would you describe your experience there? Was that different from the kinds of things you've been doing before? Or what did you think about that time?
In the PhD, in my project, so I was kind of the first couple of students in the lab. So as a result, we built the lab from scratch. So we built everything. So we knew the whole lab in and out. And then also the projects were all very focused on like, okay, this is what we have to achieve within the first 6 months, like first 1 year. And there was like concrete plan we had here. And then that helped me to get the fellowship through SUPA. And I got the SU2P to go to Stanford. And then in Stanford, the project scale was much bigger. So there was like 5 PhD students plus me working on like one project. And then we had equipments, like we had like a whole lab which was filled with equipments. Because the lab has been running for 20 years, and then the supervisor was about to like move, or like he was about to retire from Stanford and then move to Japan. So at that time we could use all these equipments to do whatever we wanted to do. So the experience is very different, because first I had like the starting up lab experience, and that was like mostly like a very mature lab experience. So the interesting part there was like you're on your own. You're like just discussing among yourselves, trying to figure out what you want to do. And then we're also competing in the sense like we know what our competitors are trying this week. So the research competition is at a very neck-to-neck competition. So you really know like what are they are trying to do today, like next week, what are they trying to achieve.
So how did you know so well what they were doing? Were they in the same building?
No, like we had like, I mean like they were all friends. So we were we were also meeting regularly in the conferences. So we will have like updates on like what they have done, what we have done, what they have done, what we have done. So we are doing these two experiments. One is to show the like spin photon entanglement experiment. The other one, so for that we also need to have like down conversion setup. Down conversion is where like you transfer the frequency of a photon from like one wavelength to a different wavelength. So we were building this setup. We went to one of these Clio meetings, and in Clio there was this like post submission session. So in the session there was this, we were about to present a down conversion experiment. But right after we presented, someone else presented the same result. So we were like, oh, it's like so close. Like, so I mean that is what I mean by like we knew like how close we were with others, and we knew like which groups were capable of what because of their like previous publishing skills, or like based on their papers and conferences, we know like okay, who is getting closer to demonstrating this particular capability.
So in that case, where you guys were presenting it almost at exactly the same time.
Yeah, actually in the end, like when we published this paper in Nature, we had both the papers come out in the same issue.
Yeah.
So right after the other. So it was very close.
So it was like, it was a tie, basically.
Yeah.
Say.
It was a tie, yes.
Do you think that was good, having all that competition? Was that helpful, do you think? Or did that make you...
Yeah, it helps you to like, because you know that someone else is also competing, and then there is a lot on stake. So you put this extra hour to like get the experiment up and running. So I mean, we had to almost run non-stop. So we had our cryostats like cold, and it was like liquid helium-based cryostats. So we had to keep it filled all the time for four or five months.
So
like someone has to come into the lab at like random time to fill the helium cryostat. So like it was non-stop.
And so that sounds like it was different in the sense that it was a very established lab and you had lots of equipment, but it also sounds like it was different in that you're the, I don't know if you would call him your advisor, but the person who was in charge of that group was probably not as involved.
He's an expert in the field as well, so he'll just give us like guidelines on like which way to take or which direction to take. So it's like Yoshio Momoto. So he has been in this field for a very, very long time, and then he's the leading expert in this field. So he would help us, but it's mostly like insights on like what we should try and what we should not try, but not into the like details of like how, like when, what is happening.
So would he like walk into lab and see how you're doing?
Once in a while, yes.
Yeah.
But not very often.
Yeah. So after working as a research fellow at Stanford and then also at Glasgow, you were a research fellow.
Yes.
And then you began to work as a data scientist.
Yes.
So how did you make that change? Like, how did you decide to do that?
So when I was in the UK, when I was in Stanford, I was seeing all these, like, competition to survive in academia. It was, like, extreme competition. Plus, because of my nationality, like, I'm from India. So as a result, I thought it would be, like, very difficult for me to, like, get into academia with my skill set. And then I thought, like, I also had previous software industry experience. Like, so in between my undergraduate and coming on to master's, I had like 2 years of software engineering experience. So I thought industry is a natural shift for me. So I thought I have to get into industry at some point. but I wanted to extend my research career as much as possible, so that's why I like stayed on for like 5 years of postdoc. I could have actually shifted when I was finishing up with Stanford. I could have shifted to like Silicon Valley jobs, but I thought like probably I will do a couple of more years of research and then move on. So that's why I did not shift immediately. And then so when once I decided I wanted to be in industry, I thought Silicon Valley was easy or like the best place to be at that time. And also like my wife is from Silicon Valley, so I thought like we'll move startup life there. Mm-hmm. So I moved to Silicon Valley and then I was looking for jobs. So the transition was difficult in the sense I did not know how to find jobs directly as a, like academic. So I always had the CV, but they just wanted to have a, like one page resume. So things like that, the small details I did not know very well. So I got into a program called Inside Data Science. Now they have remote programs as well. So they take PhD students or experienced like candidates, and then they help them to transition into industry. So it's a, like a free program. So you just register and then you do like 6 weeks of training with them.
And so it's called Inside Data Science, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Inside Data Science Fellowships.
And was that based in the U.S., in California?
Yeah, it's in U.S., California, but they have in many locations now.
Okay.
And also they have a remote program, so anybody can join online as well.
Oh, okay. And so there was sort of 6 months where you were doing that?
No, 6 weeks, actually.
Oh, 6 weeks, okay.
It's a very short program, and then it's like the whole 6 weeks is just helping you to prepare for the job.
Yeah.
Mainly for the interviews and mainly for like what you should expect in the industry. So when you go on the first day into the job, like what is it that you will see? So they give you like a glimpse of like, okay, these are the tools that you should know. These are the like processes that they follow in industry and things like that. So it was very helpful to understand like what is the industry expecting and then how to prepare for that.
Yeah. So how did you find out about that program? Did someone else sort of point
you? So when I was in Stanford itself, I came across that program. So one of my friends told me like there is a new concept like this which could help you to like switch to industry. So I looked at it at that time, but I thought like I will try it later. So when I went back, so that was the first thing that I actually applied when I got back to US, as soon as I got my eligibility to work.
So when you were working at Stanford, your advisor there was probably, I mean, like you say, a leader in the field and really experienced. But when you then shifting to do research or to work in data science, I mean, I know that as a grad student, as a postdoc, people are always thinking about the letter, you know, that your advisor is going to write you this letter or they're going to have connections and help you to take that next step. So you have this advisor at Stanford.
Yeah.
But it seems that maybe they could write you a letter of recommendation, but they couldn't really connect you to someone in your next career step.
Yeah.
That you kind of had to find that for yourself.
Yes. Because I was also moving like countries, by the time I went back to Stanford, my supervisor is not there. He had already moved on to like Japan.
So you did this, you did a research fellowship in Stanford.
Yeah.
And then you came back to Glasgow and did a research fellowship.
Yeah.
And then you started working in data science after that.
Yes.
Okay.
So my super, even I think like even when I was thinking about jobs when I was in Stanford, like I asked around like my professors, most of them were able to give me a recommend me to like some like laser companies or like some optics based companies. There was references, but I was more keen on to like shift to like industry in terms of like software engineering companies. So that part I had to like figure out by myself.
And do you know, did you just enjoy the software, working in software more? What do you think, how you made that decision, do you think? Or what was making you, what kind of pushed you in one direction, do you think?
I thought I've seen other friends who have gone into like the photonics-based companies. I thought like for me, like to survive in that industry for a long period of time will not, I thought like if I have to do the same optics experiments, things like this for like long period of time, it will be like very difficult for me.
Okay,
so I thought
so why was it difficult? Because of
difficult in the sense like I thought it was like too repetitive.
Oh, okay.
So like I don't know, for example, if a laser company is there, they're going to like make similar products for a like long period of time, then you're trying to evolve the products, and then it's the change in engineering is not so quick and it does not change very rapidly. So I thought it will, after a while, it will become very monotonous for me.
Yeah.
So I needed to, like, shift out into, like, so even, like, for my PhD also, like, so I think it's my life, like my style of like in my career. So I was like a software engineer, and then I came to do my master's in nanoelectronics, and then I switched to like photon detection, like applied physics, and then went and did with quantum dots, like spin photon entanglement, and then I came back to do photon detection. But this time, second time around, it was more about fabrication and then data science. So I think I want to have something that is changing rapidly. So that is why I thought, okay, if I go into photonics job first, probably the first 2 years or 3 years I might enjoy. But switching to software industry after that would be like more difficult. So I thought, okay, I should start off with software engineering. So as of now, I'm a data scientist, but I'm not even sure like in 5 years time I will be a data scientist. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of like shifting to some other roles. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when you think back, I'm wondering how, because I think sometimes when you think about getting a degree in a certain area, you think, well, that's a qualification, and then I'm capable of doing a certain kind of work.
Yes.
And it seems like sometimes the things that you learn in that degree aren't, so for example, I got a degree in chemistry. And when I started, I thought it was going to be about chemistry.
Yes.
But actually what I learned was that sort of the lasting skills that I developed were not about chemistry. The chemistry was kind of a small part of it. Mm-hmm. And it was more about getting an experiment running and keeping it running and working with other people who sometimes had, you know, sometimes they were not that easy to get along with, and just sharing a lab space with other people, getting things done, like getting a paper done.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering, when you look back on the research that you did, since you've kind of, at least for now, you're not doing research, but if you look back on it and think, well, what were kind of the skills that you developed there? Like, how are you different now coming back to doing data science and software as compared to before you did the research? Is there a way that you work differently or you think differently because of that research experience?
Yes, definitely. Like when I mean, now I'm working with a lot of other people who come from like different backgrounds and like different education levels. So I could clearly see the research or like the physics path, and then the research path that I took helps me to like think differently in the sense like, okay, so as you said, like the collaboration is very important. So I'm not worried to go and talk to others to find out what is working, what is not working. And then I'm not worried to like give advice, or like if something is going wrong, I can speak up without worrying, because like in a team meeting, like every week you do the same thing in research field. So you're not worried about questioning, and you're not worried if someone questions you either. So you just learn along and then just keep going. So that skill is very very interesting, that I find that like a lot of people are like not happy. Like in many cases, if they're coming out of school directly and going into an industry job, they necessarily don't have that experience. So that is one thing that was an important skill.
Yeah, that sort of questioning and being questioned and questioning others and just being comfortable with that going on all the time.
Yeah. That is one thing that is very interesting that to see. And the other thing is also like getting things done, as you say. When we are doing building a project or like any experiment, the experiment has a conclusion. Like, I mean, we might have, even if we are trying to build like a long project, we have like a lot of daily experiments that we do to, okay, this part has to be ready, this part has to be ready. So we do a lot of tiny experiments all along. So every day you know like what you have achieved, like what is done. And then if it is not done, you clearly know it is not done. So that sort of to look back on the day and say, okay, how much I've accomplished today, so you have a sense of it. So similarly in software industry, it's the same, right? You could keep writing a program or building a huge product, but you know to like modularize it, and then
pieces of it that need to fit,
and then make each piece work independently, and then you know to put them together to make it as work as a product. So that skill also I think is not taught in schools or colleges, because
it's not really
like
recognized as
as a tool. Like, so you need to be able to break down the project and then build small tools all along, and then finally you know to put them together to make it work in as a whole.
Right. So I guess that aspect of seeing a project through from beginning to end is not something you ever really do in a course or a class.
I mean the whole doing like an undergrad itself, you can think of as one project, and every course is like a small modules, but they don't realize that this is what they're doing.
Yeah, and they don't fit together the same way. It's not like if you fail one class or you do poorly in one class, you can still start out the next class without it really. And what do you enjoy most about your current job? What would you say are the things that you really appreciate there?
Okay, so now as a data scientist, I'm working with like companies which has a huge amount of data, and then they are not really sure how to use the data. Say, for example, if there is an aircraft company, and then they have building aircraft, but they are not sure like how to figure out if an aircraft is going to fail, or like how to minimize the downtime for an aircraft. So we look at their like log files, we look at the maintenance logs, and then like various other telemetry that the aircraft is producing. And then we just analyze the data to figure out if some part is going to fail. We help the user, hey, this part is going to fail, you need to take a look before it fails. So by doing this, we can reduce the downtime of the aircraft itself. And also we help all the maintainers. Like, so before, the maintainer has to figure out by himself without the data knowledge. Now we build the product, or like we build the model that will help the maintainer understand like, okay, what is it that he has to go and look first. So what I like about this project is because it helps people, and then it is not as painful as before for them, but it helps them to figure out things quickly and then make less mistakes in their job. So that is something that I really like. When I speak to them, I can understand like what is it important for them. And then you look at the data and see if what is important for the maintainer, can you find that in the data?
Yeah, so it really seems like it's a combination of, you know, your, well, to me it sounds like the experience of working on experiments and research where you're questioning and thinking about the meaning of your data, trying to understand your data, and now you're using this massive data set, but you're also kind of using your computer software background. So it's kind of a it seems like it's kind of a combination that...
Yeah, I mean, more than software, it's, I think to solve the problem nowadays, like there is like all these like open source tools that you can blindly use to get some result out. But I think it's mostly the experience of like talking to people and trying to figure out what they want. That is, then you go back to your data and then try to find them out. Mostly, I would say it's more mathematical skills and insight than the software tool itself. Like software tool is like it's very bit more easier to grasp than the other skills.
Yeah, and so that's really interesting, too, that you mentioned talking to people and figuring out what they want as one of the most important things, because I think people usually think of scientists as working on their own and never talking to anybody, but it sounds like you do that quite a bit, and that's really important for what you're doing.
I mean, like, in my PhD all along, like, so when we are building these equipments, we need to go and talk to all the technicians and, like, try to figure out what they want, and so... That sort of communication is what I'm having now, but in a different level. But it's almost the same thing, like which is easy for them, and then what is it that they want. And then they ask you questions as well at the time, like, okay, why do you want to build this in this particular way? And then you have this conversation back and forth to figure out, like, what is the best way to build the tool.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I guess this is probably my last question. I don't know, I think maybe you've spoken about this a little bit, but I'm kind of wondering if you can generalize, and maybe it's not possible, but maybe you could think of one example. So it seems like throughout your career you've had to make a number of decisions about what you were going to do next. Like, it seems to me you didn't just start with one path. You could have just started with computer science and just gone straight through and just done that, but you've sort of done computer science, and then you've done some research in physics and electronics, I guess. And so how did you make those decisions? Like, as to what to do next? Was it, oh, this sounds really interesting, or I just need a change, I've been doing too much of this, I want to try something else? Like, how would you describe when you make those decisions of what you're going to do next? Is there something that's kind of guiding you or that's helping you think through that decision?
I think at every stage when I have to make a decision, so I look at what are all the opportunities that I have, and then I'm more pragmatic, so I pick which one is really interesting at that moment, and then I go with that path. I never had like a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. Mostly like 2-year project contracts or 3-year contracts, and then once that finishes, then I'm about to finish, then I look at what all opportunities I have, and I see what is interesting, and then what skill set I have that I could use and like enhance that skill set. Then I go in that path.
That's great. That's wonderful. Thanks very much.
Thank you.